Hello, and welcome to the Investment Symposium by BNP Paribas Asset Management. My name is Daniel Morris, Chief Market Strategist, and in this report, we will be talking about why biodiversity, food, and health systems are crucial to achieving a 1.5-degree limit to rising global temperatures. We will hear from one of our guest speakers at the symposium, Professor Johan Rockström. Professor Rockström is Joint Director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, Chair of the Earth Commission, and a Sustainable Development Advisor to the World Economic Forum, the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change Conferences. Climate conferences, like the recent COP26 in Glasgow, are often viewed as largely political events. But what about the science that underpins all the debates? Professor Rockström updated the symposium delegates with the latest scientific thinking.
1.5 is not just a negotiated political number. It is, in fact, having a lot of scientific backing that it is a planetary boundary. And Glasgow, as many of you who've been following, and many of you were probably there, my way of summarizing it in a bit of a pointed way is that if we came to Glasgow on a journey to disaster, following a 2.7 degrees Celsius pathway, a place we haven't been in for the past 3 million years, we left Glasgow on a path to danger, a pathway that can actually take us, if every promise is delivered upon, from the nationally determined contributions to the net zero plans, to the methane reductions, to the deforestation halting, to the food transformation, to 1.8 to 1.9 degrees Celsius. There's so much more work to be done, but I would argue that this is a moment where we have started to see a significant pathway in the right direction. Remember that we emit roughly 42 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year today, so it gives us, you know, less than 10 years if we continue emitting as today. So a soft landing is about following the carbon law, cutting emission by half every decade, 50% by 2030, net zero by 2050. That is what can give us a 50 to 60% chance of holding 1.5 degrees Celsius line. But all IPCC models that take us safely to Paris assume a transition in the global food system from being the single largest net source of emissions, roughly 25 to over 37% of emissions originating from the whole value chain in the food system, to transition into becoming a net sink, meaning an agricultural revolution to occur in one generation. To put it simple, we have more and more evidence today that if we can have a global transformation of the food system towards sustainable and healthy food, we have a very good chance of kind of moving back into a safe operating space of planetary boundaries, which gives us a high chance of avoiding pushing the Earth system on an irreversible pathway away from the interglacial state that the Earth system has been in since we left the last ice age some 12,000 years ago, which is the precondition for civilizational development as we know it. Now, the IPCC came out with a sixth assessment report just recently, just before Glasgow, and I hope that you all agree, and that is kind of a fact established, that we've never had so much scientific evidence that we are in the midst of a global climate crisis. We've come to a point where it's, you know, unequivocal that we're causing global warming, unequivocal that we are today facing a future with much, much higher frequency and severity of extreme events. Now, we also know that these are extreme heat, you know, heavy rainfall, droughts, fires, where the food system is first victim. So the big drama is that if the food system is the single number one cause behind the risks we're taking in destabilizing the climate system and the whole life support system, it's also victim number one of its own negative impacts. So we have this interplay between food impacting Earth, Earth hitting back on food. Now, when you look at this also from a human perspective, we must now also recognize the urgency, even the planetary emergency point we're in. We're not only in a climate crisis, we have a health crisis. We are at the, hopefully, beginning of the end of a pandemic. We're also in an ecosystem crisis. We're in the sixth mass extinction of species. We're moving very fast towards losing 1 million out of known 8 to 9 million species on Earth. And we know that these crises, the health, the climate, and the ecosystem crisis are interconnected. I just give you one example, which is the hockey stick of rising zoonotic viral disease outbreaks over the past 50 years. So what we are seeing is that as we humans expand, particularly agriculture, in an unsustainable way into intact, rich habitats of wildlife, we have also rising frequency of zoonotic viral disease outbreaks, which is viruses that spill over from wildlife, often via domestic animals to humans. And then Zika and HIV and swine flu and Ebola are a few examples. But of course, COVID-19 is like the pinnacle of these crises. So if you really want to have a resilient recovery post-COVID, you want to invest in building resilience and keeping nature intact, which can only be done by having smart agriculture. The risks of losing capacity on food security is significantly high, which means that we are at risk of losing our ability to deliver on the Sustainable Development Goals, not only because we miss out on delivering on SDG 2 on food security, but also because it spills over on human well-being, security, and stability in societies.
There appears to be an accelerating sense of urgency in encouraging more action and investment towards resolving climate change, biodiversity, and food system challenges. Why the rush? Professor Rockström told the symposium audience just how near some crucial tipping points the Earth is.
What's the trajectory of travel of science? Well, over the last 20 years, we've had four IPCC assessments. And science is advancing tremendously fast on our understanding of the coupled, interactive, self-regulating Earth system. But look, as the science advances, the risk level of crossing really serious tipping points is now down in the 1.5 degrees Celsius report, confirmed in the sixth assessment, down to 2 degrees. So the more we learn of how the Earth system operates, the connections between the living biosphere and the physical components of the climate system, the larger and larger is the risk, meaning the more and more vulnerable we learn that the Earth system is. The question now is, where are we, as this generation on planet Earth, pushing the Earth system irreversibly into the future? That is the concern. When do we push on buttons of unstoppable change? And the IPCC 6 assessment does a tremendous job in mapping these risks. I just want you to be fully aware of the fact that when it comes to ice sheets, when it comes to land system, when it comes to monsoon systems and permafrost thawing, there is now a mapping. And the conclusion overall is that they still remain as low probability events of crossing tipping points of large, large systems like the Greenland ice sheet or the overturning of heat in the North Atlantic, but they cannot be ruled out and that they would have devastating impacts on the long term. And these are now mapped in the IPCC assessment. So the Greenland ice sheet is not an isolated piece of ice. It is interconnected with different components of the Earth system. Same with the West Antarctic ice shelf. The West Antarctic ice shelf is melting fast. Some scientists even conclude that it has already passed a tipping point. A summary of all the tipping point systems in the Earth system. We define these as so-called tipping elements. These are the big biophysical systems. We have between 15 to 20 known tipping element systems that we have evidence. One, they regulate the climate system. And two, they have tipping points. They can flip over from rainforest to savanna, from a permanent ice sheet to permanent liquid surface. So precaution is important. And that's why we increasingly scientifically are looking, you know, at the entire system. What are the risks of destabilizing the Earth system? The planet has been, you know, flowing back and forth between ice ages and interglacials, but never have we, according to our knowledge today, passed 2 degrees. The planet has at its warmest level always stayed below 2 degrees for 3 million years, and deep ice age is roughly minus 4 degrees Celsius. That's the corridor of life, and we are today at 1.1, and we're heading, as you know, beyond 2 degrees towards 2.4 degrees Celsius. But this is why it's such an urgency. And to recognize that the Earth system is a self-regulating system, the IPCC confirms this, showing that at 1.1 degrees Celsius warming, the IPCC concludes, scientifically verified, that we are at the warmest temperature on Earth over the past 100,000 years. Now, as if that was not dramatic enough, the big question is, of course, why are we in this narrow corridor? Well, it's not only because the orbital journey around the sun has been, so to say, so limited in climate forcing. Oh no, it's also thanks to the resilience of the planet itself. And the resilience is about the ability of the Earth system to absorb and dampen stress caused by rising energy fluxes in the Earth system. The problem is we're starting to see the absorption capacity of carbon dioxide is starting to show cracks. And this is the signs that the Amazon rainforest is starting to show the first signs of shifting from sink to source. It's thanks to intact, biodiversity-rich ecosystems, which are not yet transformed into agriculture, that we've been able to cool the planet with 0.4 degrees Celsius. The more we stress the system, the more the Earth system has been helping us, applying its biogeophysical processes to dampen the stress. This is a proof that a healthy planet is able to dampen stress to keep itself in the narrow corridor of life, the +2 to -4 corridor. And this is something that increasingly is being, you know, recognized in, for example, the IPBS, IPCC report recently on showing the necessity of nature climate sinks to have a stable climate system. The Irrecoverable Carbon paper led by colleagues at Conservation International showing, you know, the carbon sinks that we cannot lose because we won't be able to get them back into biomass and living ecosystems in time to kind of avoid a drift away from a manageable climate system. And we have so much more, resolution on where these carbon sinks are and how important it is to keep the sustainable food system within that range.
The latest climate change forecast scenarios have included the need to invest in fundamentally different land use systems, and in particular food systems, so that they contribute to the Earth's ability to absorb CO2 rather than making things worse. Professor Rockström explained why this is a crucial element in achieving the 1.5 degree goal.
How could we transition within a healthy and sustainable food system range? How can the food system transition hold the 1.5 degrees Celsius line? Well, to begin with, we have done a lot of science now showing how the food system is the primary cause behind transgressing planetary boundaries. So that quantification is done, both on greenhouse gases, biodiversity loss, land system expansion, freshwater use, and overloading of nutrients. I think it's interesting that we have two independent studies now showing that actually the real cost of the global food system of roughly $10 to $12 trillion exceeds even the market value of the global food system, which is estimated to roughly $10 trillion. And that is if you factor in all the costs of transgressing planetary boundaries, but also the health impacts of shortening the life of up to 10 million people per year due to unhealthy food. So there's a lot at stake here. The Eat Lancet Commission is the first attempt to scientifically quantify a healthy diet from sustainable food systems into what we call the planetary health diet. The planetary health diet, not surprisingly, is a flexitarian diet. It resembles very much the traditional Mediterranean diet. It is, from health science, not suggesting that the healthiest outcome is to become vegetarian, but it is to have a very large reduction of red meat intake from, on average, 700 grams per person per week for a typical American or OECD citizen in Europe, for example, down to 150 grams, basically one serving per person per week, but still having two servings per person per week of fish and two servings per person per week of white meat. But interestingly, when you take that health scientific quantified planetary health diet and plug it into an analysis of the future, you find some very interesting results. And this is quite a messy picture, but just to summarize it for you, on the upper line here, you have the planetary boundaries, the defined quantitative safe space on greenhouse gases, land use, water, nitrogen, phosphorus, and biodiversity. If we continue producing food as today, wasting food as today, and eating food as today, you're basically continuing into a danger zone of undermining the state of the planet. But if you instead adopt sustainable agricultural practices that are known today, cut food waste by 30%, and transition towards the healthiest diets as far as science can tell today, you're transitioning back within a safe operating space of planetary boundaries. So this is quite an exciting opportunity that you can have a positive win-win of health for people and health for planet by investing in healthy diets and sustainable food systems. And we've been doing continued updated research on this, verifying this work that we can today within Planetary Boundaries only feed 3.4 billion people. That's a very depressing conclusion, but a transformation, a kind of a turnaround is, according to our analysis, at least possible when investing in known technologies on sustainability in this case, with the possibility of feeding 8 to 9, even 10 billion people. 29% of small-scale farmers around the world are adopting different forms of sustainable agricultural practices that builds more organic carbon, builds more soil moisture in the soil, makes farmers more kind of sustainable stewards of landscapes. So it's not utopia, but we need to redefine what we mean by sustainable development. There is now prosperity and equity within planetary boundaries. And I think it's exciting to see how economics is really stepping on board here. The Partha Dasgupta review on the economics of biodiversity, taking on board the planetary boundary framework, saying that the economy must now abide to strong sustainability measures to operate within a safe operating space of a stable Earth system. And we have, in parallel to Glasgow, as you know, the Kunming CBD COP15 on biodiversity, which is now seriously considering a science-based target, a quantification of 1.5 degrees Celsius equivalent for biodiversity, which is moving towards net zero loss of intact nature from 2020 onwards. That won't be possible to achieve immediately, of course. So there will be kind of an inflection decade with restoration and regeneration taking us hopefully back to a net positive by 2030. That's where the whole notion of a nature positive quantification arises, with a full recovery by 2050. I think these quantifications based on science can be really important to move ourselves towards this point, which is, you know, to push ourselves across this threshold where we are also on a social tipping point towards irreversible journey back into a safe and just space on planet Earth. And the food system will be and is an absolutely key factor for us to succeed in this journey.
This podcast presentation includes a discussion on current market events and is not intended as investment advice or an offer of products or services by BNP Paribas Asset Management. Please keep in mind that the information and analysis in this presentation is only current as of the publication date.